Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak, and we have a fun show for you this morning. Our first guest, Dr. Eric Thacker, an assistant professor and range extension specialist for the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Dr. Thacker studies range management. We'll be talking with him about the balancing of livestock, elk, and horses on the open range. And Lynn, we've discussed on this program before that drought is the enemy when livestock, elk, and horses have to compete for food.
That's right. Well, good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Joseph Finder. He's the New York Times best-selling author and master of the modern thriller, according to the Boston Globe. His new book, Suspicion, is about a father who's forced to make a choice with unspeakable consequences. It's a real page-turner. These two guests, plus today's cool story when we return after these messages. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital that's part of the Intermountain Healthcare family. Healing from an orthopedic injury can be a difficult challenge, but our physical therapy team uses the most advanced tools to help you recover, like a SwimX therapy pool, which allows you to swim against a current or run on an underwater treadmill. Our state-of-the-art gym equipment addresses injury-specific cardio, strength, and balance therapies so you can return to work or play as quickly as possible. Learn more at parkcitymedicalcenter.org.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. The National Weather Service announced recently that drought conditions will persist or intensify over most of Utah through August. And this makes the balancing of livestock, elk, and horses on the open range a challenge. Our next guest will help us understand this problem, Dr. Eric Thacker, assistant professor and range extension specialist for the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Dr. Thacker, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Now, the ranchers, they're concerned about overpopulation of horse and elk, and they've requested the state to offer more hunting permits to bring those elk numbers down. Is that correct?
Yeah. From my understanding is they proposed that to the Wildlife Board a few weeks ago.
Okay. And are we obligated to provide for cattle? I mean, they have other options, don't they? And why do we subsidize ranchers by allowing them to graze? I mean, it's really a controversial question, isn't it?
It's a really sticky question. So currently, and beginning in 1934 with the Taylor Grazing Act, ranchers have been allowed to lease the rights to graze a certain number of animals on federally held property during certain portions of the year, depending on the permit. So that's been in place for quite some time. They do pay an annual lease per animal for that forage that they're consuming.
Right.
So it is a controversial subject, and there's a lot of back and forth about the impacts of grazing and whether it should occur on public land.
Right. So I believe that there are estimated to be 81,000 elk in the state of Utah, 1,000 more than the objective for the state elk management plan. How do they determine what the number should be, and then how do they determine what the numbers are?
So there's some complexity in that. So the DWR manages, the Division of Wildlife Resources manages the elk, and that's completely separate from the habitat management, which typically occurs, you know, via the Forest Service or Bureau of Land Management. So the DWR has their own methods of counting the elk and estimating that population. And those objectives are set, or the population objectives are set by the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources based upon, you know, everything from public, you know, they get a lot of public input on wanting to have hunting opportunities and live or wildlife viewing opportunities. So they come up with these population objectives that they then strive to meet. So that's where those numbers come from. And so the state has been working on that, on increasing that elk herd for quite some time.
So, Dr. Thacker, how do cattle and wildlife, elk and deer, compete? How do they tread upon the land differently, and how do they compete with each other? I mean, obviously, well, it's food, but what are the differences?
Yeah. So it's a little more complex. I think a lot of times people see it as a direct competition. It's important to point out that the reason this issue has come to the head now, or has come to a head now, is because of the drought.
Mm-hmm. It's not because of Clive and Bundy.
I'm sure that's had some influence, but I think you would have seen this. This issue's been around a lot longer than the Clive and Bundy issue.
Yeah.
But a lot of it has to do with the fact in drought years, forage is reduced just because it's drier and you grow less vegetation, and so there's less forage available. And so typically in those years, the cattlemen are asked to cut their numbers back a certain percentage to account for that loss of forage. And so it's in these years that these issues seem to become more intense in this competition between livestock and wildlife.
So,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so for each cow on the grazing land, it costs them more. And what are they currently paying for grazing land?
Okay, so they're paying $1.35 per animal unit month, which is, that's just the metric used to describe the amount of forage a 1,000-pound cow would eat in 1 month time, a 1,000-pound cow and her calf would eat in 1 month time. And so there's an equation that the federal government has used for decades that sets that grazing fee. And again, most of the competition comes, or this issue becomes more intensified during drought years. There is some overlap between wildlife, but they're different types of herbivores. So a cow is a classic, what they would call a roughage eater, where they consume mostly grasses. And then a deer, on the other hand, is the exact opposite. It's a browser, so it spends a lot of its time being very selective in what it eats, eating leaves off from, you know, bushes, and focusing a lot on forbs and tender grasses. So, and then elk is somewhere in between the two, and so most of the competition, and that's why elk surfaces the most often, as it has the most potential to directly conflict with livestock grazing. So in a good year, there's typically enough forage to go around, and forage availability may not be limiting wildlife populations when we have enough precipitation.
Here's a naive question. Do any of these animals eat sage?
So the deer, sagebrush is really important to mule deer. That becomes one of their main winter forages. So they're not a sagebrush obligate, but they're highly dependent upon large tracts of sagebrush during the wintertime. And elk will also eat some sagebrush during the wintertime as part of their winter diet. So there are some animals, and then obviously sage grouse will eat basically only sagebrush during the wintertime.
We had a gentleman on the show a year ago from the BLM, and we were talking about horses and ponies and all of that, yeah, Mustangs. And he was saying that horses, it's not the amount of food they eat, but the way they eat, they sort of destroy the plant so it doesn't grow back, and that's a challenge as well. Remember Poco, Lynn?
Yeah. How could I forget Poco?
Well, I've not had the opportunity to meet Poco. The important thing to remember about, so when we talk about grazing animals, there's also an efficiency, and horses are one of the least efficient animals in terms of they have to eat more forage in order to get the nutrient requirements that they need. Mm-hmm. So per pound of body weight, they will eat more forage than a cow. But the other problem with the horses, too, is there's a lot of trampling, which livestock and elk and everything else can also trample forage. But in terms of vegetation growing back, typically the limiting factor there is how far or how close to the ground it's been grazed. And the closer to the ground it's been grazed, then the less, there's a lower likelihood that it will return.
And so
grow back.
And so with less water, more drought, what are you seeing in terms of this vegetation growing back? I mean, does it grow back to its fullest extent each year, or are you seeing complete dying off of certain types of vegetation on grazing lands?
So part of that question I can't answer definitively because we're still feeling the impacts of drought and will for some time. It's important to remember, though, that these systems in the West evolved under drought. So drought is not a new thing to these systems. The level of use may be something that would inhibit their ability to recover. But in general, when it rains, everything does better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That sounds really simplistic, but the reality is as long as there's not long-term damage done, and that's what some of these people are concerned about, is due to excessive numbers of herbivores on the landscape during a drought time, that we may be doing some permanent damage. When the rains return, then the grass will return with it, and things will recover. It may take a few years to get that recovery, and especially in these drier regions, it may take 5 to 10 years to see full recovery. But the systems are fairly resilient if we don't damage them too much.
Mm. Well, and it's interesting as we see our climate shifting. You're talking about drought ending, but it may not. It may not, and we hear from the National Weather Service that, for example, there are more intense rain events now. So we have drought, and then we have these really monsoonal types of moisture, which I don't know if that helps regrow the vegetation. I mean, could we be in a system where a lot of this vegetation isn't going to regrow?
Well, I think that some of the concerns that some of these people have is that as things are warming and drying out, and the predictability of precipitation is becoming more erratic, that we're going to have to keep a closer tab on how many animals are on a given landscape. And I think that's part of the concern these people have is, if we're entering into kind of a new precipitation regime, if you will, where even timing of precipitation may change, and that can have an impact on the growth of plants. We need to closely watch that so that we can manage the number of animals appropriately to make sure that we're not doing long-term damage.
Right. Okay. I wanted to ask you quickly before we let you go about a lawsuit filed by a couple environmental groups in Capitol Reef National Park where grazing is allowed. And I would imagine as grazing lands become more delicate and grazing lands may even be somewhat squelched or strangled off, we're looking for more lands to graze on. In Capitol Reef National Park, they're threatening some species of cactus or something. What's going on there?
So I can't, I'm vaguely familiar with some of the grazing that's happened in the past in Capitol Reef, but I'm not familiar with, are they looking to have the animals graze the cactus?
I'm sorry?
I'm not terribly familiar with what's happening in Capitol Reef and the nature of this lawsuit. So I'm not. Are the animals supposed to be eating the cactus, or
Well, I don't think it's eating. I think they're just disrupting their root systems, to my understanding.
Oh, gotcha.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that lawsuit, so I can't speak to that.
Okay.
So Dr. Thatcher, we just have another minute or so, and I wanted to ask you, you know, the federal government owns the property. The state government's in charge of the elk and Mustang and horse herds and mules, and the ranchers own the cattle. So how do we get through all of this, and what role do public values play in determining how many, which animals roam and graze on public lands? How does all this get resolved?
Well, I think it has to start with cooperation, and I think that's the unfortunate thing that happened in Nevada with the Bundy dispute is that's not done anything to help us broadly with cooperation, and litigation seems to be a big player in this. I can't emphasize enough how complex this is. The federal government, the BLM, and the Forest Service are under legal mandate to manage for multiple use, meaning recreation, biodiversity, livestock grazing, energy development, all of these things. So they've got this big soup of management that they're trying to get their hands around. And then you have the state, which is in charge and owns the wildlife, and then you have wild horses that are federally protected on top of all of that. I think the only solution is to bring everybody to the table, because the common thread that holds this whole thing together is everybody wants healthy rangelands. The livestock producers lose when rangelands aren't in good condition. The wildlife lose when rangelands aren't in good condition. So, the common thread is everybody loses when rangelands aren't in good condition. And so that's the unifying unifying cry for these very different and very diverse groups.
Haven't heard recently about Clive and Bundy. Has that been resolved?
I haven't. I get my news probably from the same place you guys do. I haven't heard anything recently about, you know, any sort of legal action or anything. So I don't know what's happening there.
Yeah, after the pundits had a good time, a good comedic time with that, I would say it sort of disappeared. And after the big standoff, so we'll have to tune back in and see what happened with that. If he paid up on his grazing fees, doubtful.
Yeah, well,
yeah, it's an interesting situation.
We want to thank you, Eric, Dr. Eric Thacker, Assistant Professor and Range Extension Specialist for the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Thanks for being on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, if I've upset any cattlemen with any of my comments, my name is Randy Barton. All right. Well, we will return after these messages with today's cool story. And you're listening to Cool Science Radio only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly starting at 5:30, also serving Sunday brunch from 9 to 1. The website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts from Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital and part of the Intermountain Healthcare System. Park City Medical Center is proud to be consistently recognized as having some of the most engaged employees in the country. Little wonder, considering we offer all employees a pension plan, 401k, excellent insurance, and of course, year-round employment. We are currently recruiting nurses, registrars, housekeepers, kitchen staff, and more. Visit parkcitymedicalcenter.org to find your dream job.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. We just spoke with Dr. Eric Thacker about the balancing of livestock, elk, and horses on the open range. Our next guest, switching gears a little bit, in fact, is Joseph Finder. He's a New York Times bestselling author who's just written a new book titled Suspicion. This book is about a father who's forced to make a choice with unspeakable consequences when single father Danny Goodman suddenly finds himself unable to afford the private school his teenage daughter adores. He has no one to turn for financial support. In what seems like a stroke of brilliant luck, Danny meets Thomas Galvin, the father of his daughter's new best friend, who also happens to be one of the wealthiest men in Boston. Galvin is aware of Danny's situation and out of the blue offers a $50,000 loan to help Danny cover his daughter's tuition. Uncomfortable but desperate, Danny takes the money, promising to pay Galvin back. Well, what transpires is something Danny never imagined and actually something we never talk about on Cool Science Radio, but we found it very interesting. It's all about money getting wired into an account, the DEA. It wraps well into technology. And joining us now on the phone to talk about it is Joseph Finder. Good morning to you, Joseph.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Well, yes, as we said, this is a science and technology show, but we're pretty excited to talk to you because you're about science and technology as well. And specifically technology, I would say. You started off, you're a prolific writer, but you started off wanting to be a spy.
And, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I did. I mean... When I was a kid, I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't think you could actually make a living as a writer.
A lot of people don't.
right. True. And so I decided I wanted to just, I'd read the novels of Robert Ludlum, and I decided I wanted to do that. I wanted to be a spy like Jason Bourne. Well, of course, it turned out that when you work for the CIA, you're working for a large organization. They don't give you fake passports. You know, they don't give you Glocks. They don't give you Swiss bank accounts. So I decided that my skill set was more suited to writing, to making something up, than to being working for this organization.
That's good. So really what attracted you to all of this was sort of the fairy tale fantasy aspect of it, the Jason Bourne aspect.
And, yeah, and this is not reality.
Right, right. But it is now in your world as you you wrote your first thriller at the age of, what, 23 or something?
Yeah, my first book was published when I was 24. And my first novel called The Moscow Club, came out in 1991, just as the Cold War was ending.
Right. So what attracted you to Russia? You've done a lot of writing on Russia.
Yeah, I read a book called Nicholas and Alexandra about the czar, the last czars of Russia. I read some fiction by a writer named Gogol. I just decided that this was a really interesting culture. I wanted to know more about it. And they offered Russian in my high school, and I took it and sort of became a Russophile.
Yeah. Danny Goodman, who is the protagonist in Suspicion, lives on 303 Marlborough Street between Fairfield and Gloucester.
Yes.
Did you live on Marlborough Street at some point?
I didn't live on Marlborough Street. I live on the parallel street to that, which is Commonwealth Avenue.
Exactly.
303 Marlborough Street does not exist. I decided I wanted to have Danny live in a building that, you know, could exist in reality, but wasn't someone else, so I walked down the street and I said, all right, there's a number that doesn't exist. I'll use that one.
Yeah. I live right down the street. I was a neighbor. I was 313 Marlborough Street.
Oh, is that right?
Same block. And
yeah, I know that block.
Live there for...
That's where my office is.
Oh, great. Okay. And, of course, all the references to Boston, and I used to play ball in Weston, and that's, of course, where what started out to be the antagonist, Thomas Galvin. And then we start,
we start
sympathizing with him and his situation. He is handling all of the investments for the cartel, and slowly over time we find out that he's a good guy that got into into a tough situation.
Yeah, I wanted to have this character be someone who we could get to know and realize was actually a good person. He's this Boston Irish kid who who, you know, raised blue collar and was good at managing money. And he himself is pressed into a situation that he only learns about a little too late. That's Tom Galvin.
Mm-hmm. And we always love the conflict between the pure bloods of the blue bloods of Boston that have all the family money and the kids from Dorchester that does good.
Right, exactly. And you know, I sort of portray that world where they kind of look down upon Tom Galvin, even though he's a billionaire now. They sort of look down at him as not a member of the club.
Right. Well, let's take on the DEA a little bit and the kind of research that you had to do. You know, how difficult was it, you know, getting into some cold, hard facts about what goes on with surveillance and and technology within the DEA?
I have this Rolodex now of really terrific experts in money laundering, in surveillance technology, in encryption. And I actually, every twist and turn in the book, I ran by someone, some expert, and I said, could this actually happen this way? There are, you know, the spy technology that I use in the book, Danny is given a kind of a medal to plant in the office, in Tom Galvin's office. Well, that's actually a real thing. That really is something that the DEA has used in some cases. There's a scene in which Danny is forced to download the contents of Tom Galvin's BlackBerry. And the device that Danny uses is based on a real device that one of my surveillance experts told me about.
I wasn't sure if he was going to get through that scene because
that was
he had to.
Scene, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really was. It took 4 or 5 minutes to download that software.
Yeah.
He had to go back to the squash court. Yeah. He had to come up with some other excuse to get back, and then the attendants there. And, you know, I wasn't sure if he was going to make it through that one.
No, and his heart is racing. I got to tell you, there are some scenes that I write, and I actually find my heart starts racing, and I actually find them stressful. And writing that scene
is cool.
was scary, and that was like, wow, that could happen.
Yeah, you know, I found myself saying to myself, hey, Thomas, slow down. Why don't you tie your sneakers and let Danny unplug this thing?
Let Danny do his spying on you, right?
Yeah. You know, I'm curious. That's a real software program, and the metal device that was put in Thomas's study in his office is real. But also what was real is that the cartel had a lot of sweeping technologies to come in and periodically go through homes or cell phones to determine if there was monitoring software on there. So it's sort of a tough situation with all the technology that we have. There's also really good technology for determining if monitoring products are used.
Yeah, and it's all available to civilians. I mean, this stuff is on the open market.
Hmm.
So that, you know, I actually talked to a private investigator, and I said, how would you look for a bug of some sort in someone's office? What would you use? And he offered to sweep my office and explain how the technology works.
Yeah. You know, we all have watched too many movies, and for us...
No such thing.
That is true. And for us, the drug lords and the guys and girls that run the cartel are these ruthless people down in Mexico, and they're shooting their guns off, and they're, of course, beheading each other and all that stuff. But can you take us through what these organizations really look like? I mean, they're able to take tremendous amounts of money and wire them to U.S. banks who probably know this is dirty money. They have all sorts of technology at their disposal. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in some cases, I was speculating as to whether they would have access to this kind of technology. I asked the DEA about it. You know, I asked the DEA how would the drug cartels communicate, how would members of the cartel communicate with one another without being picked up. and you know they used BlackBerry PIN system for texting. So hold on, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry about that.
Well, let me ask you about the BlackBerry PIN system. So that's something that can't be detected.
There's no way for them to surveil it.
Huh. That's interesting. And was that by design?
My sources said, you know, don't put this in there that way. You know, people, I don't want people to know about this.
I know.
I struggle with that a lot in my books. How much should I actually give away? Do I want a bad guy to read about this in one of my books? Probably not.
Right. But when the good guys do, like the folks over at BlackBerry, do they say, we got to upgrade this?
Yeah.
This technology we have.
That's right. Exactly.
I got a kick out of about a year ago. Apple's a great company, but they're a little cocky because they believe, and for the most part, rightly so, that their products, it's very difficult to get in and hack them. Mm-hmm. And then we had this guy on that actually figured out that you could take a foreign power supply, a third-party power supply, and you could configure it in such a way so that if somebody plugged their Apple in just to charge it up, that they could download all this malware and take complete control of the iPhone. And as a result of his presentation at the Black Hat Conference in Las Vegas last year, Apple went nuts, and they had this thing fixed within like 30 days.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's true.
What a great – I love stories like that.
But
maybe as a result of your book, then, BlackBerry will have this thing fixed.
You hope so, right?
Right, right.
I mean, I actually was taken around a major government contractor by the CFO who pointed to this trash can, and he said, right there, we discovered a bug. What it was, you know, it was a shredder, and in the shredder was a chip that was actually reading what was fed into it. So that while they were trying to shred documents, this shredder was actually reading the documents that were being shredded, and then at some point, someone would come into the company and take that shredder back, which was basically a bugging device.
Oh, how did they discover it?
I think they had it swept, frankly, and they picked up some emanation.
Wow. Okay. Talk about how to sweep.
Well, they use RF transmitters. They sort of, but actually, it's gotten more difficult too, sweeping, because there's technologies that uses basically broadcasts on Wi-Fi, broadcasts along the internet. It's no longer radio frequency signals. So you can have a bug. In the case of the bug that Danny is forced to put on Tom Galvin's office, is broadcasting via Wi-Fi onto the internet, the Tom Galvin's internet, and sort of broadcast out that way. It's sort of new technology. It used to be basically radio frequency.
Hmm.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Joseph Finder. He's the New York Times bestselling author and has come out with this new book, Suspicion. It's all about, well, Boston. I have to say that for you, John Wells, and the technology.
Then I haven't asked him about the socks yet. I've been holding back, okay?
I don't know. For some reason on this show, we talk to so many people from Boston, which just, of course,
really?
Is after John's heart. So, yeah.
And the Bruins, that was a heartbreaker, huh, Joe?
I know.
Golly, I tell you what.
The thing about being a Bostonian is that, you know, the teams always disappoint you, and then there's always this kind of rah-rah, you know, fan fervor when they win. I mean, my daughter was a Red Sox fan. She became a Red Sox fan the year that the Red Sox for the first time won the World Series.
Yeah, fantastic. My son as well, and we went to a bunch of games, and it was just a great thing to share together. I mean, I've been waiting forever, of course.
Yeah.
Now I wasn't around in 1918, but that's a long wait.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Joseph, I wanted to tell you, one of the things that I enjoy with movies and books are the antagonists. And I got to tell you, Dr. Mendoza is one of the best written antagonists. And, he's just incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, he was a scary guy. I created this guy who I wanted him to be a bad guy, but I wanted him to be someone that you understood why he got into it. And he's sort of raised in California as this Mexican kid who has no money, and he's taken up by the drug cartel because the kid's actually brilliant. He can sort of do figures in his head. And the cartel sends him to medical school, and the price of their cooperation, their sort of helping this guy's life, the price is that he does work for them. He sort of does what's called wet work, which really means killing.
Yeah.
By lethal injection, I suppose.
With reckless enthusiasm.
Right.
This guy loves to kill.
He's a surgeon, so you know he sort of knows medical ways of doing this that cannot easily be discovered.
So through all of this, you know, we're talking south of the border and in this country, but if you look at the drug cartels from south of the border, I think maybe a naive view of it is that how did they develop all this technology? You know, they're largely uneducated, the folks that are attracted to these cartels, and yet somehow they come up with, I don't know, what was the biggest surprise for you as you learn about that culture of operation in the cartels?
Well, I was surprised at how much money they make. I mean, it really is in the billions. And I was surprised also at how the can we start this over again there?
Yeah,
sure.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, sorry about that. It's been a long day. God, where was I, folks? I'm sorry about this.
Oh, you were talking about the cartel and how you were surprised at the way they're organized.
Yeah, and I mean how much money they have, and yeah, in some ways I sort of thought that basically if they have this kind of money, what are they doing with it to sort of increase their security and sort of protect them against surveillance? I don't think all the Mexican drug cartels have this level of a sophistication that my fictional one does. But we don't know. What I learned from the DEA is that they actually have a real hard time listening in to Mexican cartel communications. They've learned how to encrypt, and this sort of encryption is on the market. It's available to ordinary citizens, and the cartels are able to purchase these things.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's you know, everyone's gotten past the regular cell phone thing. They're using encrypted cell phones. They're having conversations in rooms that are extraordinarily ruggedized so that people can't have devices outside those rooms like satellites or a listening post from a truck that goes by. And you just can't get the data.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's sort of like an arms race between the government and the bad guys. The better the technology is to encrypt, the harder we have to work to sort of to figure out ways of encrypting it. And yet, every time there's a leap in technology, that's available to the general public.
Mm. Right. And back to the movie reference. I mean, we all see these gangsters struggling with laundering money, but it's what's fascinating in reality. If you're outside the United States, you can't bring any more than $10,000 cash into this country. Yet you can wire whatever you want through Bank of America or these large banks in America that I think must understand it's dirty money.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is It's not really controversial. It's a big loophole in the law that people can wire money in without reporting it.
Where is most of the drug money held? Is it held in this country? Where is it held around the world?
Most of the drug money is held in Mexico, but we know of situations in which the drug cartels have used Russian money managers. We know of situations in which the drug cartels have sort of used bought cash intensive businesses like convenience stores or
And, you know, this is a bit of a naive question about all, you know, you talk about the billions of dollars they're making, these drug cartels. What are they make? Which drug is that are they selling most? What do they make the most money on?
I think the most money still comes from cocaine, but really? Increasing chunk of the market comes from methamphetamine.
Huh. Mm. Methamphetamine that's easily produced here.
That's right. That's right. And it's produced in Mexico.
Huh, interesting. And the cartels out of Mexico are the most powerful. Has Colombia fallen behind?
Yeah, Colombia is no longer in the picture.
Really?
I mean, Colombia was, they were all about cocaine, coca leaf.
Mm-hmm.
But as the drug cartels got into other technology like methamphetamines, Mexico was able to sort of step up and be a bigger player. Also, the Mexican government, you know, for years has been corrupt. And it's been very easy for the drug cartels to buy members of the government to sort of help cover up what they're doing.
Mm. And actually, the DEA was successful in Colombia. I mean, I remember back when they captured Pablo Escobar. And,
yeah.
And, you know, maybe even from that point on, it wasn't as strong. And I think that was, oh, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago.
Well, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, no, I mean, I at first expected the Colombian drug cartels to be the sort of main players, but really it has become the Mexicans.
Joseph, did you worry at all in the way you characterize the ruthlessness of the cartel and the way they enforced their ways of any retribution?
I don't think so. I'm not worried about retribution, but. You know, when I first started doing research on this, and I talked to some of these DEA agents, they said, "Go on YouTube and type in the Sinaloa cartel. Type in Sinaloa cartel beheading."
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
And the videos that I reference in the novel, they actually exist. I mean, these are some of the most horrific crimes you could see are put out by the drug cartels as sort of warnings to people not to inform on them, not to sort of be a turncoat.
Mm. Right.
So interesting. I heard a couple of weeks ago on NPR a report. It went into some of the towns controlled by the Sinaloa cartel. And, you know, residents just talking about what has been built for them, you know, schools
yeah.
and businesses, and the life is so much better.
Right. It's this kind of philanthropy by drug cartel.
Yeah.
And you know, so they become basically they own cities, they own governments.
Mm. Where's
sure
that
do.
Sinaloa cartel based?
Based in Sinaloa, Mexico.
Right, but isn't that the state or is that the city as well?
That's the state.
Okay. And that is the state in which cities are found?
I don't remember.
All right.
That's the sort of thing where I sort of, you know, I have my experts to bring in if they work to help me out here.
That's right. You're pretty.
Yeah,
good
your
on
acknowledgments at the end of the book. It was a couple of pages. There were a number of people that really helped out, and that's always encouraging. I'm curious. You know, the books that you've written, you've gotten a lot of attention. Certainly, Suspicion is being certainly well reviewed. What are you working on now? What's the next project?
I've got another standalone novel that I'm a good way through, which is also set in Boston.
Mm.
And it's, you know, the thing about writing standalone novels is that you can take an ordinary character and turn their lives inside out. And you can't do that in a series.
No, you can't.
I've written a couple of series books where if you have the same protagonist, you know that character is not going to be killed off because there's another series, there's another book in the series to come. So it's a very different kind of dramatic arc.
Well, that sounds like fun. I mean, you know, the handcuffs are off, and you can really go for it.
Yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, I love writing the series character. I very much. I also love writing the standalone. So I sort of feel like I've got two different toys to play with.
Mm-hmm. Will you have technology in? I assume
I
you will.
Do.
Yeah.
I always do. I mean, I'm sort of fascinated by technology. Just going back to my very first novel, where I talked to experts in the CIA and people in the Secret Service, there's always a technological aspect to my books.
hey, I've got an angle for you. And that's, you know, whatever your whatever your story is, you got a couple of rich kids from MIT that build their own drone air force. And whatever you got cooking in this book, all of a sudden, 50 drones come out of the sky and just and just start nailing everybody. And maybe on the Esplanade. Hey, just an idea.
Exactly right.
We've been hearing a lot about drones in this state recently. The drones are, they've got them down in Zion National Park, sort of torturing the sheep and things like that. So
I'm getting my own.
Lots of people experimenting around with drones, that's for certain.
Joseph, you got to put drones in this next book.
I think you're right. I think it's time for drones. I mean, if my books are going to be delivered via drone by Amazon, then, you know, why not actually have drones be characters in a sense?
That's right. And John here has plenty of time that he could act as a consultant if you needed. I think he'd be really keen on that.
I think we should do that at Grill 23. Maybe they'll be open this time.
Oh, they weren't last time you were there?
No, in your book they weren't open.
Oh God, yeah. And that particular scene when Tom Galvin comes home early and finds that that Danny is in his study at home trying to plant something.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking, what would be better than a good steak and a glass of cab?
Exactly. And a cigar.
And a cigar.
There we go. Well, Joseph Finder, thank you so much for joining us today. Joseph's book is Suspicion.
And, thank you for having me.
Nice to speak with you.
Best of luck to you, Joseph.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Again, Joseph Finder with Suspicion. Stay with us. This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Tune into KPCW every Friday to hear what local film critics have to say about the movies playing in and around town. The KPCW Friday Film Review every week during the local news hour with Leslie Thatcher, with replays after the noon news and again during the local view with Randy Barton. The KPCW Friday Film Review, sponsored by the Utah Film Center.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. I like Joseph Finder. I mean, that was a good book.
Mm-hmm. I know you liked it.
Yeah.
It's really, it's fascinating to read about all of that, and really so much more captivating to read a work of fiction that has so much of the well-researched information in it.
Yeah.
Because you really end up learning about it in a more entertaining way.
You certainly do.
And he has been, you know, critics have said that he's very accurate. So it's not just him saying he researched it.
Exactly, so, exactly.
And same in all of his books.
Well, and a common theme in Cool Science Radio is young people that get involved in robotics competitions and coding competitions and various technological products and people that young children, or not young children, but yeah, kids who once were not enamored with engineering or science, who all of a sudden they have this aha moment. And we've enjoyed interviewing a number of kids on this program.
Oh, yeah.
Today's cool story is pretty cool. And this fall, the entire British school system is going to embrace computer science. And basically, a company called Code Academy, it's a three-year-old startup based in New York City, offers free coding classes over the internet in a variety of programming languages. And more than 1,000 British schools are now leaning on its services as they prepare for the arrival of this coding curriculum. Every kid in the British Empire is going to learn how to code.
That's great, and as it should be, and the teachers need to keep up with them, actually. But the company's products are already used here in tens of thousands of after-school programs. And also Code Academy is bringing schools, in fact, announced today that they're bringing their programs to schools in Estonia. Now, we had the Code A couple of months ago here, and I don't think it was Code Academy that brought that around, but really putting it into your curriculum as every school kid in Britain will get is really incredible. And they're the first G8 country to include computer science education for every school kid.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Since Code Academy started in New York City, they have signed up 200,000 users a week. So since they've been launched in 2011, 24 million users are now connected and are taking coding classes. But here's my problem with this, Lynn. This is something we can talk about, is that 70% of these kids are outside of the United States. And Thomas Friedman, you know, New York Times writer and mm-hmm. writer extraordinaire.
Economist.
Yeah. He wrote this book, The World is Flat, the gist being if you have high-speed connectivity and high-performance laptops and mobile devices that are connected to the internet, it's leveled the playing field for people outside of the United States to compete for jobs or provide technical products or solutions that were once dominated by the United States. And that's okay. That's progress. The problem is, and I know this is controversial, but many young people outside the U.S. want a piece of the American pie. They want a nice car, big screen TV, what they define as success, and they may be in abject poverty. And here's the controversial part. Increasingly, many young Americans are frankly complacent, and they really don't have the drive compared to an Indian young man or an Indian young woman who is in poverty that see technology as a way out. Mm. So my concern is that we're not doing enough in this country. And I think one of the reasons that the United Kingdom was able to put this program together on a countrywide basis is because they can dictate the curriculum from the federal government versus here it's individual school systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a big part of it, and perhaps the reason that the U.S. is having issues bringing coding into the classrooms, and I sort of incorrectly said before, of course, all of our kids in this country have some degree of computer education in schools. Of course, in the Park City School District, a one-to-one, every kid has a computer,
yes.
A laptop after grade, I think, six it is, or maybe including grade six now. So they've got the technology. But one of the big issues with teaching coding is that teachers have to learn how to code to begin with.
So they can teach coding.
Many of us don't even know what coding is. And I have to say, during that hour of coding that they had a couple months ago, I learned quite a bit about that. The other issue that you talk about with young people across the world having more motivation than those here, they're also having now cheaper access to technology. Around the world, there are many countries. Estonia is one of them that there's free access for everyone to the internet.
South Korea, they have countrywide, they have twice the performance of our internet, and it is either free, depending upon the county you live in, or it is like $10.95 a month versus $40 or $50 a month here.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, again, goes back to the lobbying of big telecom companies, the big three, and, you know, more questions about net neutrality and things like that. It's interesting that we seem to be going in the wrong direction.
Well, considering the fact that we invented this stuff and this was our product to really excel in, and we've just fallen down.
Right. I want to thank our guests today, Joseph Finder and Dr. Eric Thacker from Utah State University, talking about grazing, and thank also our underwriters.
Oh, that would be San Francisco Design, Prudential Real Estate, Peak Art and Frame, and our new sponsor, Nexus IT.
Tune in tomorrow for Fun Friday.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, mortgage assistant for home purchases. 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service. Park City's local tree care. 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
This is KPCW Park City.